present The Expedition That Vanished, a true mystery of the sea told by Ronald Harvey.
Sir John Franklin was a wonderful example of a type frequently mentioned in British seafaring history, the grand old sea dog. At the time he became involved in one of the unsolved mysteries of the sea, he was already 60 years old. But if his bald head and slight stoop made concessions to age, his energy and initiative were quite undiminished. A man who had known every hazard the sea had to offer, who was once shipwrecked on an unknown reef, and sustained the morale of survivors in an open boat for several days, he was clearly an excellent choice for Arctic exploration. This was not just a quest for adventure or even, more importantly, scientific information. It was to find a northwest passage round the extremities of Canada from the Atlantic into the Pacific. All reports indicated that a solid ice barrier stretched across the region, and only a handful of speculative spirits believed that a passage might possibly exist. Several previous attempts had been made to locate the passage and failed. But now the British government had decided to underwrite yet another investigation, and this time they chose the formidable Sir John Franklin. Sir John's first step was to carry out a pilot training scheme. Two parties of explorers underwent hazardous trips in northern Canada to test out conditions and equipment. There followed the first attempt to penetrate into what was then, in the early 19th century, an almost completely unknown desert of ice. They had no mechanical aids, no tractors, no combustion engines, no radio, just wooden sledges, dogs, willpower, and indomitable courage. Franklin chose a small, compact unit, numbering only five, among them two young midshipmen, George Black and Robert Hood, a naturalist, Dr. John Richardson, Petty Officer John Hepburn, and himself. Canadian trappers and Indian guides completed the party, which set out overland from Hudson Bay, reached the Arctic Ocean, and went down the coast eastwards. They built a base camp at Fort Enterprise, but slowly made their way eastwards for 500 miles. Another 50 miles was won at great cost, and now their pace had become painfully slow. Winter cold, furious, unrelenting winter, pressed home its icy attack, and at last it became clear that they must get back to base as quickly as possible. The return journey became a nightmare. Food ran out, frostbite attacked some of the men, and at last they were keeping alive by eating lichen and drinking melted snow. When they at last burst back into Fort Enterprise, expecting a warm welcome, the whole base was deserted and derelict, and most of the food had been stolen. That first attempt became a gallant failure. A second, more elaborate expedition set sail on May 19, 1845. This time, two ships, specially built to withstand every kind of hardship, the Erebus and Terror, were assigned to the expedition. Admiralty instructions to Sir John Franklin were clear-cut.
To make your way through Lancaster Strait and Barrow Strait, as far as the longitude of that portion of land on which Cape Walker is situated. From that point, we desire that every effort be used to endeavour to penetrate to the southward and westward in a course as direct towards Bering Strait as the position and extent of the ice or the existence of land at present unknown may admit.
The two ships safely reached the Whalefish Islands near Disko early in July. From there, Sir John wrote to the Admiralty,
I have occupied myself on the passage in carefully reading over again the points in the different voyages which bear upon our present pursuits. And I think it is very probable that we shall find the space between Banks Land and Wollaston occupied either by continuous land or a chain of islands, more probably the latter. In which case I consider our prospects very good, and if the channels between the islands are tolerably wide, so much the better.
On July 26th, Erebus and Terror were sighted by a whaler in Melville Bay. They seemed to be waiting the chance to cross Baffin Bay towards Lancaster Sound. And then, nothing. Neither ship was ever seen again, and no member of their crews ever came back to clear up one of the most complicated mysteries in the history of sea exploration. By the autumn of 1847, the Admiralty had become very anxious at the total silence from the expedition. Two relief ships were finally sent to Barrow Strait early in 1848. They found, to their dismay, that the Barrow Strait was barred by a solid field of ice. It meant that the Erebus and Terror were hopelessly trapped somewhere behind that giant ice wall. Delay followed delay for one reason or another, and it was not until the spring of 1849 that two sledge parties set off along the north coast of North Somerset and finally turned south to explore the west coast for over 150 miles. They looked for encampments, cairns, traces of human habitation, relics of any kind, but there was nothing. A third search party combed Fury Beach, and a fourth went to Baffin Land. No sign, no clue of any kind. They now decided to leave caches of food at Port Leopold for any survivors who might make their way back. They also left, high on the beach, a steam launch and a supply of coal. Ingeniously, they devised a means of sending the news of these provisions far and wide in the Arctic waters. As Sir James Ross, commander of the search expedition, wrote,
"During the winter, a great many foxes were taken in traps set for the purpose. And as it is well known how large a tract of country these creatures traverse in search of food, I caused copper collars, upon which a notice of the position of the ships and depots of provisions were engraved, to be clenched around their necks, and then set them at liberty again, with the hope that some of these messengers might be the means of conveying the intelligence to the Erebus and Terror."
The final failure of the first search expedition was due to many factors, and endless inquiries led to bitterness among its members, the public, and the Admiralty. And then, late in 1854, a second search began, carried out this time by Dr. John Ray, chief factor of the Hudson Bay Company, and Sir John Richardson. They quickly fell in with some Eskimo sealers to the north of King William's Land, who had spoken with the leader of 40 white men he had seen dragging a boat and sledges over the ice. The Eskimos understood that the white men's boat had been crushed in the ice and that they were searching for deer to shoot for food. Later, the Eskimos claimed to have found a number of bodies, which were those of white men. Dr. Ray finally discovered indisputable evidence linking their story with the expedition. One of the Eskimos sold him Sir John Franklin's badge of the Order of Hanover, a silver band inscribed with the commander's name, and a miscellaneous array of silver spoons, telescopes, matches, and compasses. Finally, there was a vest, which removed all doubt. On it was imprinted the name of Dever, the first mate of the Erebus. The Eskimos claimed that they had bought these items in turn from other Eskimos, and that they personally had not seen the bodies, they had only heard about them. Extraordinarily, Dr. Ray did not press home his search to the spot where the bodies were said to be. But once the news reached England, orders came for an immediate investigation. When carried out, it yielded no sign of bodies, only more relics, obviously belonging to the Erebus and Terror. The Admiralty now washed its hands of the whole inquiry. Dr. Ray claimed, and astonishingly received, the £10,000 award which had been offered to the first person who could solve the mystery of the missing expedition. But this was no solution, as Lady Franklin, Sir John's wife, swiftly made clear. It concerned only a small part of the expedition. Its details were obscure, and not even a skeleton had been disinterred or a grave found. Lady Franklin now threw all her energies into organizing a private search into the fate of her husband. She propagandized, raised money, and finally bought and equipped the steam yacht Fox. She chose, as her commander, a remarkable man called Captain Leopold McClintock. This description survives of him.
"He had a short, slender, but wiry and muscular frame, well fitted for endurance and hardships. Quick in his movements as in his decisions, he was always quiet and perfectly calm, seeing everything done himself, without noise or fuss."
The Fox duly sailed in the summer of 1857 and quickly ran into trouble. She was trapped in the ice from August until the following April, drifting with giant ice packs down Davis Strait. Every kind of hazard and adventure overtook the ship in the next year, and it was not until April 1859 that McClintock and his first lieutenant, Hobson, set off to explore the west coast of Booth by sledge. At a certain point, Hobson and McClintock parted company to search different areas. Crossing over to Cape Felix, Hobson's party suddenly came upon an abandoned campsite of four mouldering tents. As Hobson later said,
"Excitement knew no bounds. We were at last in touch with a real link connecting us to Sir John, and we at once widened our search in the area."
And then, at Victory Point, they came upon a big store of food and clothing hidden under a cairn. And inside the cairn, the first real message from the missing men. It was carefully preserved in a small iron cylinder.
April 25th, 1848. Her Majesty's ships Terror and Erebus were deserted on 22nd April, 5 leagues north-northwest of this, having been beset since September 12th, 1846. The officers and crew, consisting of 105 souls, under the command of Captain F.R.M. Crozier, landed here in latitude 69.37 and longitude 98.41 west. Sir John Franklin died on June 11th, 1847, and the total loss by deaths in the expedition has been, to this date, 9 officers and men.
Here was a solution to one detail of the mystery. Sir John Franklin had died. But where were the other 80 or 90 remaining members of the crews? And what had happened to the two ships? Meanwhile, away at King William's Land, the second search party, led by McClintock, had made a complete circuit of the area and encountered more Eskimos, who were too frightened to tell them anything fresh. But a new and horrible fragment of the puzzle suddenly fell into place when they found a complete skeleton of Petty Officer Harry Pegler of the Terror, still clad in tattered remnants. The manner of death of at least one member of the crews was fully established. It still left in doubt the fate of the greater part of the expedition, but by now McClintock and his crew felt that they were hot on the trail. There were even some who cherished the belief that if they persisted long enough, they might indeed create a miracle and suddenly, one day, come face to face with still living members of the missing crews. Certainly, they seemed to be in the right vicinity to find the solution to the mystery, and they went to work with a will. And then, on May 8th, McClintock reached another Eskimo village, and there fresh relics came to light, including a silver plate carrying the initials of Franklin and others who were part of the expedition. Communication was difficult, but slowly McClintock pieced together the story of how the Eskimos came into possession of the silver. Reluctant at first to talk for fear of reprisals, they were quickly reassured and revealed that they had met white men who'd left their ship icebound. Some were weak and sick, they said, and others asked for, well, what we would call directions. Unaware of Hobson's discoveries elsewhere, and not knowing that Franklin was certainly dead, McClintock felt that the solution was almost within his grasp. Next, he stumbled on clothing, which could not have belonged to Eskimos, and in one pocket he found a pocketbook full of half-decayed letters. But the letters were unreadable. Presently, McClintock arrived at the point where he was due to join up with Hobson, only to find that Hobson had arrived early and had continued on up the coast. He'd left behind a letter revealing the news of Franklin's death and all his other discoveries. McClintock now persisted in his search and made another find. He came upon a ship's boat with its back broken, and lying beside the boat, 2 shotguns, both loaded. But horror waited inside the boat. It contained the skeleton remains of a number of human beings, and some of the bones had been gnawed by wolves. Much more remarkable, a wooden box buried nearby in the ice contained well-preserved food from a large store of chocolate and tea to tobacco, soap and ammunition. What terrible fate had overtaken those men? Where was Sir John Franklin buried, and what fate overtook the Erebus and Terror after they were abandoned? A possible and sensational answer to the last question now came to light. In April 1851, Captain Coward of the two-masted brig Renovation left Limerick in Ireland, outward bound for Quebec, Canada. On the seventh day at sea, the ship suddenly ran among icebergs. And what icebergs they were, huge, glistening monsters which seemed to blot out the sky. This was very unusual. They had expected to encounter some pack ice at this time of the year, but not these solemn, beautiful, glowering monsters. Captain Coward at once ordered every possible man to the rails, armed with picks and fending poles. They stood there, lining the ship's rails, while the icebergs, like a pack of elephants, moved round past the tiny ship, dwarfing it, threatening to crack it between their enormous flanks. Presently the icy breath of the monster spread over the whole ship, and the men at the rails shivered. Another sound now added new terrors. The berg seemed to crackle and growl as it demolished minor obstacles in its path. The whole of St. Paul's, cast in ice, would not be quite so big as this berg. And there they were, with flimsy spikes, hoping to fend it off like innumerable Davids and a supreme Goliath. It was the helmsman who saved the day. With great skill, he succeeded in avoiding a head-on clash, and the icebergs all but brushed past them. And then an amazing thing happened. Suddenly, high up there, as if in the monster's jaws, trapped on one great shelf, were two full-sized, apparently undamaged ships. Everyone stared in astonishment. The hulls and even the rigging seemed intact. Telescopes were brought to bear on the apparition, but there was no sign of life. One ship was heeled over on her starboard side on her beam ends, and the other perched high on the ice with her rigging in perfect order. The Renovation survived to tell the tale. Were these the missing ships Erebus and Terror, lost years before and now endlessly doomed to drift the seas, preserved in the grip of an iceberg? It was possible. But once again, tantalizingly, no completely convincing evidence could be given. The whole long quest for the missing crews and ships now developed a fresh impetus, with the intervention of Captain Charles F. Hall, a big bearded American, who believed that a man of Captain Crozier's caliber would certainly have tried to preserve the records of the expedition in a safe place. He now set out to find them. This time he took with him two Eskimo interpreters, and between them they put together fresh evidence, some enlightening, some confusing. In later years, after Captain Hall's death, his journal and manuscripts were bought by the American Naval Department, and Professor J. E. Nurse went to work to construct a narrative around them. Captain Hall's papers produced one important piece of evidence. He had sought out and interviewed a man and his wife belonging to one particular Eskimo tribe. They had pitched their camp close to the two trapped ships in 1847 and returned again in 1848. They gave eyewitness accounts of the crushing of one of the ships. Yes, they had met and communicated with the chief of the white people, known to them by the name Tuluak. Captain Hall reported their description of him.
He was an old man, with broad shoulders, thick and heavy set, with gray hair and full face and bald head. He wore spectacles, was quite lame, and appeared sick when they last saw him. He was very kind, always wanting them to eat something. But despite his ill health, he was always laughing. Everybody liked him.
This was a clear-cut description of Sir John Franklin. As we know, after Sir John's death, Captain Crozier took over command. When the partial July thaw came, he must have watched with dismay while his two ships were carried southwards by the ice, hopeless prisoners. When winter came down again, still trapped in the ice, disease and death must have begun to attack them. It must have been clear to Captain Crozier that so long as they stayed aboard the ships, they would remain the helpless victims of the ice and sea currents. Wherever the trapped ships drifted, they must go. But what a terrible choice confronted him. The ships obviously offered a protection they would never find on the ice. Once out there in the wastes, they must rely upon tents and whatever food could be carried on sledges. Nonetheless, they might easily remain trapped in the ice year after year and eventually die of madness, if nothing else. So it came about that on April 22nd, 1848, Captain Crozier gave the order to abandon ship and take to the ice. But now he seems to have made the remarkable decision to take some of the ship's boats with them. Laden with stores and provisions, the boats were dragged painfully across the wastes of ice for mile after mile. Obviously, this could not last. From the evidence available, it is clear that on 3 complete days, they covered less than 16 miles. 16 miles, when their faintest hope of finding help lay many hundreds of miles away. The idea that they could have lived off the land with the help of Eskimos was dismissed by Captain McClintock in his fascinating account of the voyage of the Fox.
The supposition that some may have protracted their existence among the Eskimos or upon the resources of the country is altogether untenable. Upon the whole of King William Island, and also within the mouth of the Back River, only 8 or 9 families were met with. And had they succored our famishing countrymen, they most certainly would have told us. The retreating crews could not have carried with them more than 40 days' provisions, a very short allowance. That any considerable number of them reached Montreal Island, a distance of about 250 miles by sledge route, is marvelous. Yet here they were, separated by 600 or 800 miles from any land sufficiently abounding in animal life to sustain them. And the Back River, by which they hoped to obtain access to this more favored region, was still frozen to a depth of 5 or 6 feet.
In a desperate throw to reach Great Fish River, Captain Crozier must have decided to abandon most of the ship's boats with their provisions. Carrying iron rations, on April 25th, he left this message at the cairn. We start tomorrow for Great Fish River. The man whose complete skeleton was found by McClintock was named Henry Pegler. We know this from a clever piece of chemical investigation carried out on the letters in the pocketbook found near Cape Herschel. As McClintock wrote at the time,
by the aid of chemical agents, Mr. F.G. Nethercleft of 32 Brewer Street, Golden Square, has been able to decipher the name High Pegler, together with several particulars respecting him. Stature, 5 feet 7 and a half, hair light brown, etc. A reference to official documents at the Admiralty shows that Henry Pegler joined HMS Terror on 11th of March, 1845, as captain of the foretop, his age then being 37 years. The papers let in a gleam of light upon their habits and afford some grounds for the belief that up to April 1847, they were confident and cheerful. A year later, he prepares himself for the long and, as it proved, fatal march. Discarding his seaman's attire, he dressed himself in his best suit of shore-going clothes, reserved to be worn on the day of landing once more in England. He took with him his pocketbook and also a comb and brush. In all, there is no trace of despondency, nor of departure from ordinary customs. Hence it is impossible to resist the inference that their discipline continued perfect, and that they conducted themselves throughout that fearful march like brave men to whom despair was unknown.
From thence on, the mystery remains unsolved. A few skeletons on a ship's boat, but nothing to account for the greater part of the expedition, and even more mysterious, the bows of the boat pointing in the wrong direction, north. Did this mean that the remaining 95 men had decided that the trek of several hundred miles was utterly impossible? And did they, at this point, turn back towards the Erebus and Terror, craving once again their shelter, hoping a thaw might, after all, at long last, free them? The wastes of icy sea and snow still hold their mystery. Only one hopeful discovery has since transpired. In 1904, the Norwegian, Ronald Amundsen, did at last find and traverse the Northwest Passage.
The story of the expedition that vanished was written by Vincent Brome and told by Ronald Harvey.